like very much, says Elizabeth. Joyce nods. You're not really going to kill him, Elizabeth. I don't think you'd bring me if you were really going to kill him. Elizabeth studies Joyce for a moment. Who on earth do you think I would bring? Ron? She hoped that might make her friend laugh, but instead Joyce looks scared. The train begins to slow as it approaches London. Chapter 33. They are going to kill me, reads Ibrahim. Only Connie Johnson can help me now. She was frightened, I can tell you that, says Connie Johnson, her feet up on the desk. They have been allowed a private meeting room because of the importance of good mental health. Frightened, repeats Ibrahim. Frightened of you? Connie shakes her head. I know when people are frightened of me. Frightened of someone, though. Perhaps you like it when people are frightened of you. Ibrahim is making notes on his pad. What would you say to that? Are we doing therapy, says Connie, or are we investigating a murder? I thought we could mix the two, says Ibrahim. In therapy, you must never waste a crisis. People being frightened is not my thing, says Connie. Thank you for my grazie, by the way. It's perfect. I don't get a kick out of people being scared of me. I just do it because it's easy to monetize. So, who was she frightened of, says Ibrahim, do you think? Connie shrugs and sips at the cappuccino a warder has made for her. It even has chocolate sprinkles. Felt like she had a secret she was scared to tell. A secret that she seems to believe you know, says Ibrahim. Only Connie Johnson can help me. What did she say to you? She gave you a clue, perhaps? If she did, I didn't pick up on it, says Connie, but I'll keep thinking. If you would, says Ibrahim. Do you have secrets, Connie? Nah, says Connie. The combination to the safe in my lockup, I suppose, but I don't think that counts, does it? What are your secrets? That's for another day, says Ibrahim. Let's start from the beginning, when you heard what had happened. With the knitting needles? With the knitting needles, yes, says Ibrahim. What did you think? Connie takes a pause and breaks off a piece of Kit Kat another warder had brought in on a tray. Well, first off, I admired the ingenuity. Not easy to kill someone with knitting needles. Agreed, says Ibrahim. And second, I thought I shouldn't have given her the knitting needles, says Connie. But you can't be ruled by hindsight, can you? That is a wise thing to say. Too late for her now, says Connie, draining the last of her cappuccino with a wince. If I look into it a bit more, do you think you could bring me a new coffee maker? I've got an espresso, but I'd like a DeLonghi. I shouldn't think so, says Ibrahim. Connie nods. Well, try your best. Here's the only thing I can remember. When I went into her cell, Heather was writing something. Ibrahim stops writing and looks up at her. What sort of thing? Connie shrugs. She hid it away pretty quickly. Worth looking for, though. They'll have bagged up all her stuff. And what was she writing? Says Ibrahim. It wouldn't have been the note she left. Connie shakes her head. It was lots of writing. She was scribbling away. So, what do you think, Connie? Why kill Heather Garbutt? And why kill her now? What I think is this, says Connie. I think this doesn't feel like the therapy I'm paying for. This feels like I'm an unpaid member of your gang. Well, we are all unpaid, but your point is valid, says Ibrahim. It is a legitimate observation. Let's talk a little about you. Would you like to start, or shall I? You start, says Connie. Ibrahim thinks for a moment. I think you are unhappy. Wrong, says Connie. I think you make other people unhappy, says Ibrahim. I'll give you that, says Connie. So you know you make other people unhappy, and yet you are happy? It must be hard to make peace with that fact. Other people are their own responsibility, says Connie. Connie, you are very bright. You are hardworking. You spot opportunities. I think it is fair to say you are more powerful than many other people. Connie drums her fingers on the table. Maybe. So therefore you are a bully, says Ibrahim. If you are strong, you have a choice in life, to protect the weak or to prey on the weak. You use the strengths you have been given to prey on the weak. So does everyone, says Connie. I don't, says Ibrahim. Only sociopaths do. Well, then I'm a sociopath, says Connie. You should try it. It's very lucrative. You sensed Heather Garbutt was frightened, Connie, and you sensed she was unable to tell the truth, and I think you cared about that. Connie pauses. Not especially. You didn't care? Not really, no. Not really, no? Yet you think I should find out what Heather was writing. You think maybe there's more to her death than meets the eye. Maybe, says Connie. I have good news and bad news for you, Connie, says Ibrahim, shutting his pad. Enlighten me, says Connie. The good news is that you care, so you are not a sociopath. And the bad news? The bad news is that means at some point you are going to have to come to terms with everything you have done in your life. Connie stares at Ibrahim for a long while. Ibrahim stares back. You're a fraud, says Connie finally. Nice suits, I give you that, but a fraud. Perhaps so. There is a series of beeps on Ibrahim's phone. And that's our hour up. More next week. Or is that us done? It's always your choice. Perhaps I am too much of a fraud for you. Connie gathers up her magazine and places the rest of the Kit Kat in her Hermes clutch bag. She stands and holds out her hand to Ibrahim. More next week, she says, please. As you wish, says Ibrahim. I'll keep digging for you, says Connie. And I shall do the same for you, says Ibrahim. Chapter 34. What did you make of Pauline? Asks Elizabeth. I like her, says Joyce. Well, I like her too, says Elizabeth. But what did you make of her? I asked her about the comments from the other day, says Joyce, about Bethany's clothes. But she batted them away, and she said she had no memory of the notes. It's almost as if she were trying to lead us to something, says Elizabeth, or away from something. She agreed we should talk to Fiona Clements, though, says Joyce. She thought that was a tremendous idea. Elizabeth raises a doubtful eyebrow to her friend. The black cab pulls in, and Elizabeth and Joyce step out. Elizabeth takes a good look around. Who is watching? There are guards at the door of the American Embassy up ahead, and there's a group of young women going through the revolving doors of a publishing building on her left. Looking up, she can see plenty of windows, plenty of places in which to hide and watch. A sniper's paradise. Joyce is also looking around, but with an entirely different focus. There's a swimming pool, says Joyce. I know, confirms Elizabeth. In the sky, says Joyce, looking up and shielding her eyes from the bright winter sun. I told you you'd like it, says Elizabeth. The swimming pool runs between the tops of two tall residential buildings. Its glass floor makes it seem suspended in mid-air. Elizabeth is unimpressed. It's just engineering plus money. Perhaps some imagination too, but she bets they copied it from somewhere. Perhaps if someone had built it for the public to use, she would marvel at it. But you can only swim in the sky if you have money, and if you have money, you can do pretty much anything. So forgive her for not getting excited. And this is where he lives, asked Joyce. Victor. That's the information I have. Do you think he let us have a go in the pool? Do you have your costume, Joyce? I didn't think to. Do you think we'll be coming back any time? Elizabeth feels the weight of the gun in her handbag. Not for a while, no. They walk in through the huge double doors of one of the residential buildings and make their way across the marble lobby to the burnished walnut and copper concierge desk. The whole place feels very expensive, yet deeply inoffensive, like a business hotel a divorcee might choose to kill himself in. The concierge is very beautiful, East African, perhaps. Elizabeth gives her friendly a smile. She's no Joyce, but she does her best. We're here to see Mr. Elliot. The concierge looks at Elizabeth very pleasantly, but very certainly. I'm afraid we have no Mr. Elliot in the building. That would actually make sense, thinks Elizabeth. Victor Elliot had 100 names. Why use the real one here? You're very beautiful, says Joy to the concierge. Thank you, says the concierge. As are you. Is there anything else I can do to help you today? Elizabeth's phone buzzes. The Viking again. She looks at the message. I hear you are in his building. Killing him at home is a nice touch. I look forward to hearing from you shortly. How to get upstairs? Have you ever used the pool? Joyce asks the concierge. Many times, says the concierge. Just to let you know, a member of our staff is on his way to escort you to the exit at your earliest convenience. I think I'm more impressed with it than Elizabeth, says Joyce. Elizabeth, says the concierge. Elizabeth Best? Yes, dear, says Elizabeth. Things are looking up. Mr. Ilyich told me if an Elizabeth Best were to visit, to show her up straight away. He said she might also be called... The concierge looks down at a list. Dorothy, D'Angelo, Marion Schultz, Konstantina Plishkova, or the Reverend Helen Smith. He also told me to watch and learn because Elizabeth Best is the cleverest woman he has ever known. Elizabeth sees Joyce roll her eyes. You didn't think when we walked in, asking for Victor Ilyich, that I might be Elizabeth Best? That didn't cross your mind? I'm terribly sorry, no. The way Mr. Ilyich spoke about you, I thought Elizabeth Best must be a much younger woman. Well, says Elizabeth, I used to be much younger, so you're excused. Mr. Ilyich is in the penthouse. I will show you up myself. The concierge turns to Joyce, and I will show you the swimming pool when you leave. There are spare costumes for guests. Elizabeth sees the delight on her friend's face. There will be no swimming today, but they might need towels. After the trip up in a lift the size of a suburban sitting room, Victor Ilyich answers the door himself, thanks the concierge, and lets Elizabeth and Joyce into his penthouse. He couldn't look more thrilled to see them. There she is. How did I get so lucky? How long has it been, Elizabeth?
20 years, says Elizabeth.
20 years, 20 years, nods Victor, and kisses her on both cheeks. I look so terribly old, don't you think?
You always looked terribly old, says Elizabeth.
Victor laughs. I did. Always. Finally, I am old. Finally, I make sense. Now, I think you are Joyce Meadowcroft.
Joyce reaches out a hand, but Victor kisses her on each cheek.
Lovely to meet you, Victor, says Joyce. Do you know they kiss 3 times in Belgium? I only found that out recently.
Victor smiles and takes her elbow.
Please come with me and sit. It is too cold to sit out, but we can enjoy the view. I hope you like grey clouds and red buses.
Victor leads Joyce over to a sunken sofa, which hypothetically looks over a huge vista of London. The grey clouds obscure most of the view today. The only things clear enough to be made out are the building sites of Battersea Power Station, as a whole new swathe of London takes shape on the banks of the river. Elizabeth follows behind them.
Joyce, says Victor, I think you would like a gin and tonic.
That's what I think. Tell me if I'm right.
You're right,
says Joyce. Then that's what we will have. I'm so happy to have you both here. Elizabeth, you will join us?
Sit down, Victor, says Elizabeth.
I will, says Victor. Come on, I'm excited. Let me make the drinks, then we can sit and talk. Two old spies. We can make Joyce's hair curl with our tails. Sit down, Victor,
says Elizabeth again, her gun now in her hand. Chapter 35.
I speak, then you speak, says the producer.
He is called Carwin Price, and DCI Chris Hudson has been left in no doubt of that because Carwin Price likes to refer to Carwin Price in the third person.
I speak, you speak, I speak, you speak, I speak, you speak. Got it, says Chris. I speak, you speak. That's my only rule. That's the Carwin Price rule, says Carwin Price.
Do I look at the camera? Asks Chris.
No, look at me. That's the other rule, says Carwin. Unless you're making an appeal. Have you seen this man? That sort of thing. You can do that down the barrel.
Down the barrel?
Straight into the lens, says Carwin. That's what we call it in news.
Down the barrel means something very different in the police force, says Chris.
Carwin is wearing a woolen beanie hat indoors. Donna will have an opinion on that. Donna is watching from a chair at the side of the small Southeast Tonight studio. When Chris had received the call, come and screen test, the guy on the phone had said, "Let's see if Carwin Price likes you."
"Who's Carwin Price?"
Chris had asked, and the guy on the phone had said, "I am." "Okay, I'm going to shoot a few questions," says Carwin. "You zing back with a few answers, and we'll find out if the camera loves you."
"Good luck," calls Donna from the side of the studio.
"Quiet on set," says Carwin. "We're not in a zoo."
Why had he agreed to this, Chris wonders. A little too late, of course. His mouth is drier than he had imagined possible. It's like he has just woken up from a fitful sleep on a long-haul flight.
"I'm joined by Detective Sergeant Chris..."
"Detective Chief Inspector," says Chris with difficulty.
"Don't ever interrupt," says Carwin. "I speak, you speak."
"Sorry," says Chris. "I just thought, you know, for accuracy."
"On live TV?" says Carwin. "That's what you thought, was it? If I put you on my show, this is what I get. You piping up every 5 seconds?"
"We're not on live TV, though," says Chris. "I promise I wouldn't do it if we were." Carwin mutters, "Jesus Christ," under his breath. This seems to be going badly. Chris realizes he needs the loo, too. How can he need the loo when his mouth feels so dry? He looks over at Donna. She gives him a thumbs up, but it lacks conviction.
"I'm joined by Detective Chief Inspector Chris Hudson of Kent Police," says Carwin, not even looking up now. "Detective Inspector, robberies are up, violent crime is up. Surely the people of Kent deserve better than this."
"That's a very fair question, Mike. I think..."
"Mike?" says Carwin,
which feels like an interruption, but Chris thinks it's best to let it go.
"Yes, I thought you were being Mike Waghorn," says Chris. "Sorry." "I'm Carwin Price, mate," says Carwin. "So I'm being Carwin Price."
"Sorry," says Chris again. "I just thought you were the producer, so..."
"So I don't exist," says Carwin. "Because you haven't seen me on TV?"
"No, I just..." Chris looks over at Donna again, but she's pretending to look at her phone.
"Sorry, I haven't done this before." "That's coming across," says Carwin. "I'm doing this as a favour to Mike, you understand that? I'm missing jiu-jitsu for this."
Chris nods. "Sorry, of course." To his surprise, Chris realises at this point that actually he really would like to be on television. He doesn't like Carwin, sure, with his hat and the chips on his shoulders, but he likes being in the studio, likes the camera pointed at him. It's quite a surprise for a man who would have avoided a mirror a few months ago. He sees Carwin puff out his cheeks. "Last chance, Chris. Let's nail this."
I'm Carwin Price, and I'm joined by Detective Chief Inspector Colin Hudson of Kent Police. Chris lets this go. How much he has learned already. Robberies are up. Violent crime is up. Surely the people of Kent deserve better than this. They do, Carwin, says Chris. It's the right question to ask, and if I had a simple answer, I would give it. I'll start by saying we live in a very safe part of the world. I don't want your viewers to worry themselves too much, but one robbery is a robbery too many. One instance of violent crime is... Chris catches Donna out of the corner of his eye. A real thumbs up this time. One too many. So I give this promise. My fellow officers and I will not rest... The studio door swings open and Mike Waghorn saunters in, tossing his bag onto a chair. Here he is, my great find. Carwin seems to find a politeness around Mike Waghorn that he hadn't been able to muster around Chris. Mikey boy, Carwin says. Yep, just put him through his paces. I'll just bet, says Mike. Hello, Chris. What do you make of all this? Love it, says Chris. To be honest, I didn't think I would, but I do. Mike sees Donna. And your better half. What do you think, Donna? He's actually very good, says Donna. No need to screen test him, Carmen. I'll vouch for him. You know my instincts, says Mike. Of course, Mike, says Carmen. He's definitely got the X factor. We're talking about knife crime in a couple of days, says Mike. Put him on. That all right with you, Chris? Yes, says Chris. In a couple of days, on TV, knife crime. It's like all his Christmases have come at once. He can't wait to tell Patrice. Well done, boss, says Donna, rising from her chair and giving Chris a hug. Chris's mind is galloping ahead. Perhaps this will turn into a regular slot. Your friendly Bobby dispensing advice, perhaps a little bit of wisdom along the way. Chris looks at the monitor on the studio floor. He looks good. Do his eyes twinkle? He could swear they do. He sees Mike look at the monitor too, but he realizes that Mike is not looking at him. Donna, says Mike, you really pop on camera. I mean, really pop. Pop, says Donna. Chris has a sinking feeling. Shine, zing, pop, says Mike. Last time I saw anything like this, it was a young Philip Schofield. Wow. Oh, thank you, says Donna. What do you know about knife crime? I want you on a set of Chris, says Mike. Donna holds up her hands in protest. Chris will give her that. Sorry, Mike. Choose Chris. Mike puts his hands on Donna's shoulders. I don't choose anyone, Donna. The camera chooses, and it's chosen you. Mike turns to Carwin. Carwin, take Donna into wardrobe, see what we've got. Carwin takes Donna out of the studio. She gives an apologetic look over her shoulder as she goes. Mike places a hand on Chris's shoulder. Sorry, Chris, he says. That's show business. Chris nods, the warmth of potential fame leaving his body. Chapter 36. Elizabeth, don't even joke, says Viktor Ilyich, the gun pointed at his head. I wish I were joking, Viktor, says Elizabeth, and watches Viktor sit. Joyce is open-mouthed. Elizabeth, says Joyce. Don't get involved, Joyce, says Elizabeth. Not this time. I need you to trust me. Killing Viktor is the only option we have.
There are many options, Elizabeth, says Viktor. Sit and talk. We will work it out. I chose not to kill you after I received the photographs. I could have, you know.
What photographs? Says Joyce. I know you could, Viktor, and I'm sorry, says Elizabeth. You should have done. But the man who wants you dead knows I'm here. He has people watching everywhere. She takes her phone from her bag and holds it up. I can show you messages to prove it, so I have to kill you. I'll make it quick, and we'll bury you properly.
Elizabeth, says Joyce.
Sorry, Joyce, says Elizabeth, putting her phone down on the table beside her. I truly am. Now you get to see what I'm really capable of if my hand is forced. Where shall we do this, Victor? Where is quietest? I don't want to alert your lovely concierge.
If it was me, then the bathroom is quiet, and you can clean it easily, suggests Victor. But you really don't have to do this. We are friends, no?
We are friends, Victor, yes, says Elizabeth.
The guy who sent you, says Victor. He's Swedish, right?
I can't tell you, Victor, says Elizabeth. After this, I don't want to hear from him or think about him again.
We team up together. We kill him. That's a better plan. Come on.
It's all too late, says Elizabeth. I don't know who he is, and you don't seem to know who he is, and I just want this over with. I want peace at home with my husband. I'm so sorry. Let's head to the bathroom. You lead the way. Victor stands. Joyce stands too.
He's going nowhere, says Joyce. Not while I'm here.
Victor places a hand on Joyce's shoulder.
Joyce Meadowcroft, you have my thanks, but this is business. Someone is going to shoot me one day, and at least Elizabeth is a friend. This Swedish guy wants me dead, and maybe this is the best way.
Joyce looks at Elizabeth, and Elizabeth nods. It can't always be a game, Joyce. I'm sorry.
I will never forgive you, says Joyce.
You have to trust me, Joyce, says Elizabeth. Best friends.
Not anymore, says Joyce.
She turns away from Elizabeth. Elizabeth is surprised at how much this stings, but she understands. Victor walks towards the bathroom, Elizabeth following behind, gun raised. No sudden movements, Victor. Let's just get this over with.
Last chance to stop this now. You know I loved you, Elizabeth, says Victor.
Where does love ever get us? Says Elizabeth, following Victor from the room.
Tied up in the back of a van, shot in a penthouse, I'm done with love.
Victor opens the door to the bathroom. His voice is now loud, imploring.
Please, let me turn around and we can...
Elizabeth pulls the trigger. Chapter 37. The truth is, you simply don't get enough vitamin D in prison, and in Connie Johnson's view, that contravenes her human rights. She doesn't like the story her mirror is telling her, one bit. She's too pale. When she gets out of here, she's going to the Maldives. Life can't just be about work, and perhaps it's time to spend a bit of that money she's made. Perhaps St. Lucia. Or France. Where do civilians go on holiday? Connie has been abroad only twice in her life, once on a school trip to Dieppe, where she'd been sick on the ferry and a geography teacher had tried to kiss her behind a hypermarket, and once locked in the boot of a BMW and driven to Amsterdam by two Liverpudlian brothers with whom she had had a difference of opinion. The Liverpudlian brothers and the geography teacher had all soon regretted their actions. Slap on the fake tan, all you like, have your Botox and your fillers, but the three things the skin can't survive without are vitamin D, vegetables, and plenty of water, preferably sparkling. They don't serve fresh vegetables in prison, but through the contact of a contact, Connie has an Abel and Cole box delivered once a week, and another of her contacts in the kitchen can work wonders with a parsnip and an aubergine. She takes her vitamin D tablets. But there's no real substitute for sunshine when you're supposed to be locked up for 23 hours a day. She has a machine for sparkling water. Connie is thinking prison would be very, very difficult without a bit of money and some VIP status. It's still not great. But much like travelling first class on the train, she's going to be stuck there for a while, and the toilets aren't ideal, but at least someone brings her a cup of tea every now and again. Either way, she's going to have to get out of here sooner or later. Sunshine on her face, a gun in her waistband, and a gym where you can do reformer Pilates. She doesn't need much. Through the security gates and on to D-Wing now, Connie thinks about Ibrahim, that wise old owl. On the whole, Connie has not had good experiences with authority figures telling her what she should and shouldn't do, but Ibrahim, with his nice suits and his kind eyes, for once in her life she doesn't feel like she's being told off. Connie passes a cell that is being hosed down with a pressure washer. She gives the spray a wide berth as she's wearing suede, and there is only so much the prison laundry can do, however much cannabis you smuggle in for them. Connie has never really spoken to anyone the way she is speaking with Ibrahim. What is it? Honesty, perhaps? Connie can be a number of very different people when the mood takes her. She puts on different faces if she wants to scare you, if she wants to sleep with you, or if she wants a prison warder to bring her a Nando's. But doesn't everyone? Isn't everyone doing that all the time? Presenting a certain side of themselves to other people? So what side is she presenting to Ibrahim? And why does it feel so different? Connie climbs the metal staircase to Heather Garbutt's landing. Someone is shouting in their cell further down the corridor. Something incoherent about asylum seekers. If you took everyone with mental health issues out of this place, they'd have to shut it down. Most people in here were, in one way or another, just taking another step in a life of chaos, pulled by the tides of a world which neither wanted them nor needed them. Very few people in here were like Connie. Just plain bad. Connie reaches the door of Heather's cell. It is still empty because of the internal investigation into Heather's death. The man in the admin block, the one with the Volvo from Tinder, has assured her that it has been left open. Connie walks into the cell, cold and empty in Heather's absence. Only Connie Johnson can help me now. Well, let's see what we can do, Heather. Let's see if we can find what you were writing. There are very few places to hide anything in a cell. Connie starts knocking on the walls, trying to hear a hollow sound, but the walls are too thick. No way through. Connie reaches her arm around the U-bend of Heather Garbutt's toilet. Nothing. Connie can fool anyone and everyone. She is very good at it, and it has served her well for many years. When her dad left, Connie kept smiling, just so someone in the house was. When her mum died, Connie ploughed on, building the business. No one was any the wiser about Connie's pain. The bed frame is made from tubes of cheap metal, hollow tubes. Of course, even while she's thinking it through, Connie knows what Ibrahim is doing, the mirror he's providing. He's letting Connie speak to herself, to see herself. And he's helping her understand that if you're fooling everyone, you're really only fooling one person, and that's yourself. Ibrahim had said to her, "Our great strengths are also our great weaknesses," and Connie had rolled her eyes, but for some reason that thought is with her all the time now. Connie upends the bunk beds and pulls a loose rubber stopper out from one of the metal legs. Nothing but an empty space. Keep looking. What if she wasn't just plain bad? What if that's a lie she has told herself all these years? That would be too much to take. She could just stop seeing Ibrahim, but it feels like he has opened a door that can never be shut again. She pulls the stopper from the second leg of the bed. Nothing. Plenty of people have dealt with an awful lot worse than Connie Johnson. She knows that. What she does for a living is despicable. How she makes her money. How she treats people. How she shuts off her brain to the pain that she has caused. It has always felt inevitable to her, though. As if she were born this way. And as if different rules applied to her. She pulls out the third stopper. Still nothing. But what if none of that is true? Does she really want to be confronted with everything she has done? Connie pulls the stopper from the final leg. On balance, no. She doesn't want to find that out. It is probably best to just keep on lying to herself. Best to remain the Connie Johnson that the little girl invented when her dad left her all those years ago. She will let Ibrahim know she doesn't want any more sessions with him. Thank you, but no thank you. Connie hooks a finger into the hollow bed leg and feels the paper immediately, rolled up tight. There are 5 or 6 pages, perhaps, all tied with a rubber band, and she slides them out. Connie slips off the rubber band and flattens the pages as best she can. They are covered in neat handwriting, blue ink. She reads the first line. Through the bars, I hear the birds. In the bare cell with the thick walls, Connie has surely found something that will interest Ibrahim. Ibrahim had set her a task, and she has achieved it. She quickly scans what Heather Garbutt has written, but it seems to be, of all things, a poem. She was hoping for a nice, simple confession, or the name of a co-conspirator, something to help solve the murder of Bethany Waits, but no such luck yet. Connie knows it could still be helpful, though, feels it in her bones, and even if she can't make sense of it right now, she knows someone who will. She should probably do one more session with Ibrahim. Show him the poem, just until they've worked out what's going on here. Chapter 38. Joyce. Where to begin? Sitting on my sofa, watching a programme about trains, is a man called Viktor Ilyich. He's a former KGB agent. He's Ukrainian. I told him I wanted to write my diary, and he laughed and said I had plenty to write about today, but I have left him with a glass of sherry and a slice of cherry and dark chocolate cake. I saw it on Instagram and thought it had Ron's name all over it, but as it turns out, Viktor is getting the first slice, which goes to show how plans can change. The rest is in Tupperware for Ron, though. Hold on 1 second. Okay, I'm back. I just went through to the living room and asked, and Viktor says the cake is very good. I know he would say that anyway, but he's had the whole slice, so let's assume he's telling the truth. I don't normally like dark chocolate as a rule, but it really works here. It has kirsch in it too, so that helps. The programme Viktor is watching is about a train that goes through the Rockies in Canada. You should see the views. Viktor said they just spotted a bear. I went to London today with Elizabeth. She told me we were going to see an old friend of hers and that she was going to kill him, which I didn't quite believe, but Elizabeth had been bundled in a van a few nights ago with Stephen, so things were certainly afoot one way or another. As I say, I didn't know quite what to think, but I trust Elizabeth. Also, there was a trolley service on the train, rather than a buffet car. When we arrived in London, we went to the flats where Viktor lives. There is a swimming pool, but I will tell you about that another time, because I think I should get on with telling you what happened. Wait another moment. I'm back again. Viktor has just been to the loo and couldn't get the flush to work. There is a knack, and I told him. Gentle, gentle, gentle. Then, all at once, I told him you can pause the TV when you go to the loo, but he already knew. I paused the TV during countdown just to make it less stressful. If ever I watch it with Ibrahim, he doesn't let me. He says I am only cheating myself. Viktor lives on the top floor of the flats, the penthouse, and he's a funny-looking little thing, like a very happy tortoise. He was delighted to see Elizabeth, and he even gave me 2 kisses, so I thought there was no way Elizabeth was going to kill him, and I was just waiting to hear what was up. Viktor offered me a gin and tonic, but then Elizabeth pulled out her gun. I had words with her about it, but she wasn't for backing down, and Viktor seemed to take the whole thing in his stride. Honestly, I was scared, and I was angry with Elizabeth. I even told her I would never forgive her, which she reminded me of on the journey home. You should always trust me, was her take on the thing, but as it happens, I think my anger was useful. Off they both went to the bathroom. Victor yelled out something or other, and there was a gunshot, and I heard Victor fall to the floor. I was shaking, I admit it. In fact, if I'm admitting everything, I was crying, which again, as it turns out, was also useful. Elizabeth rushed back into the room and issued instructions. It was something like, "No time for tears, Joyce. I had to do it, and Victor knew it, but now I need your help." She said she was on cleaning duties in the bathroom, which I was glad of at least, but she needed me to make a couple of calls. I was to call Bogdan on her phone and say, "Elizabeth needs a taxi," and then I was to take the SIM card out of her phone and cut it into pieces, and then wipe the phone clean and put it into the waste disposal unit in the kitchen. There must be no physical or electronic evidence that we had ever been in the flat. I thought to ask about the concierge, but I didn't because I feared the answer. Off she disappears again, and I call Bogdan, and he says hello, and I say Elizabeth needs a taxi, and he asks if I'm crying, and I say I'm not, and he says good, there's nothing to cry about, and he will be with us in an hour. Then I ask how he is, but he has already rung off, so I took out the SIM card, which was difficult because I was shaking, and cut it into pieces, and then took the phone into the kitchen and threw it into the chute. I heard Elizabeth call out, "Have you done it, Joyce?" And I called back very quietly that I had, and that's when Elizabeth and Victor walked back into the living room, casual as you like. I looked like I'd seen a ghost, and who can blame me? Then Elizabeth talked me through it all. The text messages from the Viking had been the key. He knew our every move. He said he had people watching us at every step. But Elizabeth saw through it. She says she can't be followed without noticing. She's too canny. There was no one on the train, for example, so she knew the Viking had pulled a much simpler trick. He had simply cloned her mobile phone while she was at his house. I say simply, you know what I mean, and was able to hear and occasionally see everything that happened right up to the moment I destroyed the phone. That's why she had to keep me in the dark, so my reactions were natural and believable to the Viking. In fact, that's why I was there in the first place, to make the whole thing sound completely real. I told Elizabeth I could have acted, but she laughed. I asked if Victor was in on it, and she said that as soon as she held the phone up and told him about the messages, he understood her plan. I asked Victor if he was worried before then that she was really going to kill him, and he said that he was assuming she wouldn't, but with Elizabeth you could never tell for sure. Elizabeth scoffed and said, "As if she would kill him." And Victor said, "You would." And while Elizabeth kept protesting, Victor finally poured me the gin and tonic I'd been promised. An hour or so later, the concierge came up with Bogdan, who was carrying a very large holdall. Victor told the concierge that he was dead, and she nodded and asked how long he would be dead for. So he looked at Elizabeth, and she said that a couple of weeks or so should do it. The concierge works for Victor, it turns out, and in the end she even helped Bogdan carry the holdall to the car, with Victor keeping as still as possible inside in case the Viking had someone watching the building. Victor took two very heavy-duty sleeping pills because he has been in this sort of situation before, and it was the only way through being locked up in a confined space. After 20 miles or so, when Elizabeth was certain we weren't being followed, we went to the very top of a multi-story car park in East Croydon, opened the boot, unzipped the bag, and let Victor out. I promise you this is true. He was fast asleep, and we had to slap him awake. I said I wouldn't mind one of his sleeping pills, but he said they're too strong for me. You have to get them from America. So, here we are. Victor couldn't stay with Elizabeth, So he will be in my spare room for as long as he is dead. The plan is to find out who this Viking is, and then find out where he is. After that, I suppose the plan is to kill him. I don't know. I don't think we can keep Victor dead forever. I have questions about the Viking and about Victor, but tomorrow is Thursday, so they can wait until the whole gang is here. Where does this leave us with the Bethany Waits investigation? It feels like it might be a distraction, but Elizabeth says it's actually enormous luck, as Victor can help us while he's here. Alan usually pops in to see me while I'm writing, but he is conspicuous by his absence. Now there's a new, interesting Ukrainian man in the flat. How fickle he is. I will go and shake a packet of biscuits in a bit, and then we'll see who's boss. I can hear from the other room that the train program has finished and Victor is on his feet. It sounds like he's doing his own washing up, which bodes well. I know I was a stooge today, and I know it was important, but I'm not entirely at ease. Something isn't sitting right. There was the shock, of course. That can knock you sideways, but also something else which I've been trying to put my finger on all afternoon. I think it's this. You see, when Elizabeth pulled that trigger, I really did believe it. I really did believe she was murdering Victor. That my best friend was capable of murdering a man she has known for many years just to save her skin. In fact, I didn't just believe it, I knew it. So what does that say about Elizabeth? And what does it say about me? Chapter 39. The Thursday Murder Club liked to meet at 11 a.m. in the Jigsaw Room. That is how things should be. It moves around from time to time. Ibrahim understands that, of course he does. There have been murders to deal with, and let no one say he is not flexible. But really, calling a meeting of the Thursday Murder Club at 8 a.m. at Joyce's flat, when they have an active murder investigation ongoing, words will have to be had. He calls for Ron on the way, and he tells Ron that this is very much the thin end of the wedge. Ron agrees, or at least doesn't seem to strongly disagree, and so Ibrahim feels emboldened. A schedule is a schedule is a schedule. A laminated schedule even more so. Again, Ron raises no objection to this point. In fact, Ron is unusually quiet all round. "Do you smell of cannabis, Ron?" asks Ibrahim.
"I might do," concedes Ron.
"I'm of half a mind to declare this meeting unofficial, you know, unless I'm given a good reason."
"Well within your rights, old son," says Ron. "You give him hell."
"Thanks, Ron, I will," says Ibrahim. "Why do you smell of cannabis all the time now?"
"Pauline," says Ron.
"Oh, I see," says Ibrahim. "That covers it."
"It's a lot stronger than I'm used to," says Ron. "I keep falling asleep on her bathroom floor."
Ibrahim presses the buzzer to Joyce's building, and the friends are let in. "Lift or stairs?" asks Ibrahim.
"Lift, why not?" says Ron.
Ibrahim has noticed that he is trying to hide a limp, still not using his stick. They exit the lift, knock on the first door on the right, and Joyce lets them in. She gives them both a hug in turn.
"Oh, Ron, are you wearing perfume?" asks Joyce. "It reminds me of something Joanna used to wear."
Ron grunts and takes off his coat. Alan has approached him with interest and starts to lick his hand with professional thoroughness. Ibrahim spots Elizabeth seated in the living room.
"Now, forgive me, but I must speak."
"Must you?"
asks Elizabeth. "I must. Good morning, Elizabeth, and a very early morning if I might be allowed the observation."
"And to you," replies Elizabeth, motioning for him to continue. "We are the Thursday Murder Club.
That is not news to anybody. We meet at 11 a.m. each Thursday in the jigsaw room. Let me take those three data points one by one.
Cup of tea? Asked Joyce.
Thank you, Joyce. Yes, says Ibrahim. Point one. We meet on Thursdays. On this point, I am satisfied. It is indeed Thursday. We need discuss this no further.
Ron, you absolutely reek of very high-grade skunk, says Elizabeth.
It stays in the hair, says Ron.
Point two, we meet at 11 a.m, and here you see our paths diverge, as it is 8 a.m.
Is there a reason? Is there an explanation? None has been forthcoming.
How is Pauline? Calls Joyce from the kitchen as she fills the kettle.
Ron grunts a non-committal reply.
And from there on to point three, continues Ibrahim, we meet in the jigsaw room, and without putting the point too bluntly, I see no jigsaws.
Skunk is very good for arthritis, says Elizabeth.
I don't have arthritis, says Ron.
And I've never seen the classified files on the assassination of JFK, says Elizabeth. Pull the other one, Ron. It's got bells on.
So, before we go any further, continues Ibrahim, I want to know if there is a good reason, and my definition of good will be strict, as to why we are meeting here and now, because it plays havoc with my spreadsheet.
Alan lollops into the room from the hallway, tail wagging, and makes an immediate beeline for Ibrahim. He starts tugging at Ibrahim's sleeve.
Here is another man who is confused, says Ibrahim, now ruffling Alan's head. Another man who understands the importance of consistency. A man who knows it is walk time, not meeting time.
Alan lies on the floor and exposes his belly for Ibrahim to tickle. Joyce puts his cup of tea on a side table.
Thank you, Joyce. And so, my point is this. I was expecting to meet at 11 a.m. to talk through the latest developments in the Bethany Waits case, to discuss perhaps the note left by Heather Garbutt, to hear from Ron about Jack Mason. I even have some exciting news for you from my source at Darwell Prison.
Joyce, is Alan's collar a little tight?
No, says Joyce, unless you know better than the super vet.
So, unless something fairly spectacular has happened in the last 24 hours, and I think I might have spotted that, I see no reason why we can't move the meeting back to its regular time and its regular place.
You would spot it, says Elizabeth, if something had happened.
I am observant, yes, says Ibrahim. Now, I want to show you something.
How many pairs of shoes were there in the hall?
I am not observant of shoes, says Ibrahim. I am not perfect, Elizabeth.
Why are we meeting at 8 a.m? Asks Elizabeth. And why are we meeting at Joyce's? You want a good reason?
Were there four pairs? Asks Ibrahim. That's my first guess.
A number of days ago, starts Elizabeth, while you were fluttering your eyelashes at Connie Johnson, and Ron was, I don't know, being seduced, perhaps. Ron raises his cup of tea and a toast to that. I've played a bit of snooker as well, though. I was kidnapped, alongside Stephen, and driven to, of all places, Staffordshire. Not now, Alan, I'm talking. After regaining consciousness, I met a very large gentleman we are calling the Viking, real identity as yet unknown, but we are working on it. He had a proposition for me. I was to kill a man named Viktor Ilyich, a former KGB station head, and if I failed to kill him, or I chose not to, I would be killed.
Okay, says Ibrahim,
but even so. I haven't finished here. Yesterday morning, Joyce and I travelled up to London to visit Viktor Ilyich.
Wait till you hear about the swimming pool, says Joyce,
Alan curled uncomfortably on her lap now, his eyes darting around, thrilled by all this unexpected company.
Quite so, says Elizabeth. We entered the penthouse apartment of Mr. Ilyich, whereupon I proceeded to pretend to shoot him dead in one of his many bathrooms.
I didn't know it was pretend at this point, says Joyce.
Bogdan then kindly made his way up to London, and we stuffed Viktor Ilyich into a hold all, and he drove us all back here.
Good lad, Bogdan, says Ron.
As far as we are aware, the Viking believes that Viktor is dead, so we are out of immediate danger, but that situation will not last for long, and we need to find and neutralize the Viking before he realizes what we've done. So we are meeting at 8 a.m. because we don't have a second to spare, and we are meeting at Joyce's flat because she is hiding a former KGB colonel and criminal kingpin in her spare room. He also has a great deal of experience in money laundering and interrogation, so I will set him straight to work on the death of Bethany Waits and Heather Garbutt. Is that an explanation you find acceptable, Ibrahim?
Ibrahim nods.
I knew it would be something like that. Yes, given the circumstances, I waive my objections.
That is good of you, thank you, says Elizabeth.
Ibrahim looks up and in the doorway sees Viktor Ilyich with a cup of tea and some toast. Viktor gives him a huge smile.
Everybody is here, the whole gang now. Alan, you're too big for Joyce's lap, I think.
Viktor, I am Ibrahim.
I have been told you are handsome, says Viktor, but I didn't expect you to be this handsome.
Ibrahim nods. Yes, it takes people by surprise sometimes. What is it like to be dead? Is it freeing?
Yes, this is my first slice of toast as a dead man, and it is delicious, says Viktor.
It's Waitrose multi-seeded, says Joyce. It's in the freezer for special occasions, so don't get used to it.
I should get shot more often, says Viktor. Maybe in heaven, Joyce makes the breakfast.
I don't think either of us will be going to heaven to find out, Viktor, says Elizabeth.
Maybe in hell, Ron makes you breakfast, says Ibrahim, and everyone laughs, except Ron. Hello, I'm Ron, says Ron. A man with the heart of a lion, says Viktor.
If you say so, says Ron.
Ron is harder to compliment than Ibrahim, Elizabeth tells Viktor. When Elizabeth first met Viktor, which would have been sometime around 1982 and somewhere around Gdansk, he already had a fearsome reputation, a reputation for intelligence rather than for violence, which marked him out as someone to worry about. He had risen from the ranks of the Leningrad KGB at that point and was running agents in Scandinavia. He would later rise and rise until he was at the very top table of the KGB. Which was no mean feat. He had eventually fallen out of love with the whole system, however, and gone freelance, which explained why he owned a penthouse. They had met in a bar by the port to exchange prisoners without rigmarole, and several bottles of vodka later, their friendship had been established. Eventually, they were as close friends as sworn enemies could possibly be. Elizabeth had never imagined she would end up faking Victor's death in a London penthouse, but neither had Elizabeth imagined having a best friend who didn't listen to Radio 4. Sometimes you simply have to swim with the tide.
I think I should like to ask, if I may have the floor, says Ibrahim, why did Elizabeth have to kill you?
Not now, Alan.
The criminal underworld is all linked, says Viktor. The Colombians, the Albanians, the New York mob, they all do different things. They all fight, but sometimes they need each other. Sometimes they need someone to bring them together, someone they trust with their money. when it moves through the system, and that's me. I make sure everyone plays nice, everyone makes money, and I make sure people don't kill each other.
But they do kill each other, old son, says Ron.
I know, says Victor, but not as much as they would. I do what I can. Now, in every country, I have men like Martin Lomax who work for me.
Elizabeth thinks back to Martin Lomax, that beautiful house they went to visit.
So, you see, you killed one of my guys, says Victor.
Sorry, Victor, says Joyce.
You probably had your reasons, says Victor.
We did, says Elizabeth.
What happened to his diamonds? Asks Victor.
Long story, says Elizabeth.
So, who is the Viking? Asks Ron. Why does he want to kill you?
The new generation of criminals are different, and they like to launder their money in a new way. No gold, no diamonds, no bureau de change, or car factories, which is how I launder money.
Alan sneezes.
Bless you, Alan, says Victor. The new generation clean all their money through cryptocurrency.
Ah, like Bitcoin, says Joyce, nodding.
Yes, like Bitcoin, says Victor.
And like Dogecoin and Ethereum, adds Joyce, taking a sip of her tea, and Binance Coin, which is rocketing up this morning.
Elizabeth looks at her friend. They will have a conversation about this later.
And cryptocurrency is the Vikings' business. That's the story here?
Victor nods.
But I tell people to steer clear of cryptocurrency.